is Shona Lane. I'm Education Officer here at the Western Plains Cultural Centre.
Okay, joining me today is our manager, Andrew.
Good afternoon.
Assistant Curator, Caroline.
Hello.
Curator, Kent.
Hi.
And Collections Officer, Jess.
Hi.
All right, today we're focusing on One Forward the Instant, which is the latest exhibition in the project space and has been curated by our own Kent Buchanan. The exhibition features paintings and three-dimensional work that reflect on the natural world, technology and contemporary culture. So as normal, Kent, if you can reflect on the title for us first before we start discussing.
Sure.
Okay.
The title relates to photography and the seemingly instantaneousness of the image, of the photographic image, versus the slow formation of a painting. The works encapsulate an idea, and in a sense, the beautifully composed, simply composed images, essentially you feel as if you will get it all in an instant, that there is contained within the painting everything you need to know about landscape.
But also I think there is something happening within his works about the relationship between photorealism and the expectation that the audience has that photorealistic paintings or traditional realism should just be all up front. It should be understandable in an instant.
Mm.
But there isn't a lot necessarily going on in terms of the sort of depth of meaning. Whereas with Wan's images, you do have that instantaneous impact, but then there are the many layers of meaning and kind of richness to them that reveal themselves to you the longer that you stay with the work.
But is that a relatively recent understanding? I mean, and I would agree that people now look at representational art and just go, well, it's just a measure. How much does it look like an apple?
Mm.
And I'm going to give it a score out of 10.
Mm.
Perhaps give it the people's choice in the Archibald.
Mm.
But, you know, if you go back many centuries, art was representational and dripped with meaning.
Yeah.
So is this, are these, in a sense, extremely traditional works rather than extremely modern works?
I think it's more an impact on people's understanding of art through something like abstraction, that they know, they kind of accept that abstract art is about things they don't really understand. It's about symbols and meaning and all this kind of dense stuff that isn't necessarily visible.
So, or it's not art at all.
Yeah.
Depending on the person.
Yeah. Or so there's a tendency, I think, to look at things that look representational as being, oh, it's simple, I can understand that. And that's all they kind of expect from it. Because every artwork, you know, even the most traditional representational, has
meaning.
Something else going on behind it. But it's not necessarily that we take the time to try and find out what that is.
I think in some ways they are modern paintings in the sense that there is shorthand in the work, in the sense that he's not depicting, you know, a vista of the Australian landscape to talk about the landscape. They are essentially a native, some native flora that has been arranged like a bouquet, and then another element has intruded on that. And so that that other element is a synthetic element that reflects on the landscape, the effect on the landscape. So there's sort of shorthand in the sense that in the past, works were filled to the brim with symbols and references, whereas these are quite succinct and in a sense are ready for us to spend time with and draw ideas out from, rather than all those ideas being in there and that we should be able to pick them up just by looking at it.
I think people really appreciate that. I can remember a couple of comments at the opening and people finding it really refreshing that it is, you can just appreciate the work for the incredible technical skill that's demonstrated, and that's it. And even Juan himself said when there was questions raised about environmental activism and things like that, he said, well, no, that I wasn't necessarily intending that, and that's a reading you can take from it yourself, but, you know, I hope for readings to be taken for this for decades to come, and it really doesn't matter what they are. So people can bring to them what they want rather than, you know, trying to...
they have to know what the rule
exactly,
is
that's
to
right.
decipher a painting.
Yeah.
I mean, there's definitely, in terms of the way that the paintings have been designed, there's a tremendous amount of time, I think, spent by the artist to get the composition right. The arrangement of both the synthetic element, how it relates to the natural element. I'm sure that the artist spent a lot of time getting the right angle, the way that the leaves sort of splay out in particular areas. So on a formal level, there's quite a lot happening in terms of its arrangement as a still life, as a number of angles and tonal variations and shade, etc.
I just wanted to pick up on what Ken and Shona have referred to about the way that Weinfort is providing us with a blank canvas in a way that he refused to entertain people's suggestions of a sort of subliminal message, and I think everyone really appreciated that. It's quite different from what people have become used to, that, you know, art is embedded with political message or emotional stories. And for me, Weinfort's works are a vision of the future, and I understand that he's built his paintings referencing the past, but for me, it's in the light and the searing white Australian light, which you almost need sunglasses to look at these paintings. And for me, that's a sort of apocalyptic vision of the future that, you know, and the fact, the way that the exhibition is lit as well. I think Kent's done an amazing job with the lighting in the exhibition design, that they are appearing as projections on the wall. And that's one thing I've noticed whilst I've been in the space. People, the first thing they say is it a photograph? And then they say, is it a projection? And people, it's adding to that cinematic kind of vision of the future, which we are glimpsing through his paintings.
I think the other thing that the paintings are about is about our unease with our own landscape. I think it's taken us a long time as a country to embrace the flora of our landscape. Compared to an English country garden, our flora is spiky and alien, and I think we're still working through that. And certainly by, you know, walking around and looking in people's yards, certainly a lot more natives in people's gardens than there used to be. And in a sense, the elements that he's added to the flora is sort of prettying it up. There's an idea, I suppose, that we still have a kind of a feeling that we're not as impressive,
or feeling that our landscape is not necessarily fitting into a very long tradition of landscape aesthetics. That our landscape is, you know, a square peg in a round hole in that sense. So it's very much about that kind of looking at the landscape and trying to appreciate it for its, not just its symbolic qualities, but its aesthetically, its visual qualities, and the way that we can appreciate the colour and the form and the shape of the Australian landscape.
That's right. I think also the largest painting in the show, which depicts the landscape around Broken Hill, is a landscape painting, but to my mind is more like a snapshot. You know, three quarters of the painting is sky, which obviously relates to the Australian experience, particularly out west. But there doesn't seem to be a lot in that painting that's particularly landscapey. It's just this sort of bottom quarter of the painting is this scrubby kind of barren landscape with this stripe of road. And in a sense, the bouquets say a lot more about landscape than that does in some respects. Mm. It's certainly a depiction of what the landscape looks like.
I think the large piece, the Broken Hill piece, is very much trying to capture what the landscape feels like.
That's right.
So it's not necessarily, and that's what Australian landscape painting is quite often about, is less about rendering the landscape as it looks, but trying to evoke the experience of the landscape and its its meaning and its value and its symbolism in Australian culture. So I think in terms of that landscape tradition within Australia, that work certainly fits very well into that.
Mm.
We talked about before that kind of menacing, overwhelming, isolating experience that you have within the Australian landscape.
And the godlessness of
yes.
it.
The vast emptiness of it all.
Okay, moving on now to what's happening at WPCC. Kent, can you tell us what's happening in exhibitions?
This week we're installing three shows. In the main space, we've said goodbye to Art Express, and we are welcoming an exhibition of works by Tracy Moffat, which is toured from Monash Gallery of Art. The exhibition is called Narratives and looks at three bodies of work by Tracy Moffat produced over the last 15 years. We've supplemented the exhibition with a fourth body of work as well as some of her video work. So all of her work, in a sense, deals with notions of narrative. And so it'd be a really great opportunity to catch work by an artist who has really risen to the top in terms of Australian art and is a pretty heavy hitter in terms of the international art world. In the regional art space, we'll be seeing an exhibition of work by an artist from Lithgow named Julie Williams. She is a photographer and it will be a really moving exhibition about a place that has significance to the artist. So I would encourage everyone to come to that exhibition, which opens this Saturday at 2 o'clock. In the new media space, we'll be presenting an exhibition by Julia Burns, a new media artist based in Sydney. This work features triple projection, so there are three objects in the space that have projections over the top of them. So that will be opening on Friday night along with the Tracy Moffat exhibition.
All right, Andrew.
Yes, and look, something to put in your diaries and your iCalendars and your Google Calendar or whatever. For November, we are getting Space Invaders, which is a show from the National Gallery of Australia. It's got the zines, posters, stencils, graffiti, stick-ups, all sorts of things. It's a really interesting show about street art, basically, and just keep your eyes out because we're intending to put on a fairly impressive public program with lots of chances for you to actually, you know, get your hands dirty and do some stenciling and some hands-on work, but that's in November, so just keep an eye out for it.
And in education, this month signals a return to Box of Tricks, Blast from the Past and Artwork. So that'll be happening all through September on Wednesdays and Thursdays. Okay, moving on to what's happening elsewhere, and there's a couple of things we're going to talk about. The first of which was an article in The Australian in relation to a $20,000 cash artwork which sold for $21,350. The artist is Dennis Babois, a Sydney-based artist, and the artwork involved $20,000 in cash in a pile. So what do we think?
I think it's an artwork for a media release. The work is sort of conceptually interesting in the sense that he's kind of asking the question of what something is worth. That's a question that is risen every single time a work sells at auction. I think it's a very one-dimensional artwork that once you realise what he's doing for that millisecond, you've pretty much got it.
I think it's a wonderful way of extracting maximum value from your arts grant because you don't have to pay for a studio or material. You just take in the cheque and say, can I have this in $100 bills and then wrap it up and then sell it.
Yes, we should note that this wasn't funded by the artist himself. This was funded by a grant. So he didn't go down to the bank and withdraw all his money.
No, he just threw the cheque in. But I do take your point that it was for a media release. I mean, if you look at the story, he's saying, oh, I wasn't sure. I thought it might sell for $15,000, which is laughable because it's $20,000. And so what it's going to sell for is $20,000.
I think it doesn't do great things for the world of art in the eyes of the general public who don't know a lot about art. Having watched the 7 PM project report on the story with my husband, who straight away just said, that's ridiculous, you know, in terms of increasing, I suppose, the respect that people have for artists and art making practice, this doesn't do wonders for it. Mm. If people are doing things that, which are, it's a gimmick more than anything else, so that's what it comes across as.
I think, I mean, I've ensured the wrath of everybody here by by saying that I don't have a problem with it. I think it's quite funny. I think it's quite biting. I think it's holding up what we all do here is a bit ridiculous sometimes. So I think conceptually, I think it has merit. I think that, yes, it's an artwork for a media release, but that was the point of the artwork, to be
attention-grabbing.
Mm-hmm. It kind of would be a failure as an artwork if it didn't get people going, oh, well, that's ridiculous. I think that was its point, really. And I think that if we start to sort of make suggestions about, oh, you know, you didn't have to have a studio or make anything or, you know, buy canvas or whatever, we start to make big assumptions about what an artwork should be and what we expect from artworks.
But then if we go your way, we've got no standards at all. As long as you call it an artwork, then you go,
That foundation for art was established in 1917, so that's not something that's only new. That's been around for nearly 100 years now, this idea of I'm simply deciding that this thing is an artwork and that's my decision as an artist and my decision as a creative person. It's up to the community to put the value on whether that is a successful artwork or not. And in this case, someone's obviously decided that it is because they paid more than what it was valued at. And I think that, for me, it raises the idea that why is that work any less valuable than $120 million for Andy Warhol?
The point is that it's the fact that there is nothing. I mean, he's wrapped them up in two bits of paper with a bit of sticky tape. Let's put that over the top. And in that case, I'd say he's an absolute failure, because if you are referring to, is it Marcel Duchamp? Okay, in 1917, he probably sold his ceramic pissoir for more than its value, and he's only just got, he's got, you know, less than 10%. He's made a 5% turnover on his investment, and I think, you know, that's pretty poor. If you're an artist and you were looking at 5% on top of your raw materials, you'd be a starving artist.
You would be, but if you were also an artist who was making artwork deciding, oh, I can make a 20% investment back on this artwork, you shouldn't be an artist. You should be an investment banker or a trader or something. That if you were going into making art based on, I'll get a return on this, your priorities are the wrong way around, from my point of view anyway.
Well, isn't that what he's done?
What do you mean?
The artist?
Isn't that what he's done? But I don't know that that was necessarily his desire. I'll make this because I'll make another $1,200 on top of it. Because there's much easier ways to make $1,200 than apply for Australia.
I think
it was pretty easy once he got the cash.
Yeah.
It was half an hour's work, wasn't it?
And I think the work is very glib, and I can see the point he's trying to make, but I don't know that it's got much.
It hasn't got much long-term resonance,
no.
Certainly, and I think it certainly is glib, but I think its glibness was part of its point.
I think that... okay.
We can excuse anything now.
Talk about Bill Drummond, the KLF member who in the 90s burnt $1 million, which of course outraged everyone, and has gone down as a apocryphal kind of action, and may not be remembered by most people, but you know that act in itself is probably a bit more challenging than putting $20,000 up for auction. In the same way that someone like Chris Burden in the 70s had a friend shoot him in the arm, and that was an artwork, which of course everyone goes, oh, that's stupid, why would he do that? That work actually said a lot more about the time it was made, the rise of the televisual image, the rise of war being depicted, etc.
I would like to be the Australian. I mean, if he didn't sell the artwork, is he then allowed to use it? If he keeps it, does he have to keep it as $20,000? Like, can the person who bought it, can they now take $100 down to the TAB and put it on the 7th at Flemington?
They can, according to this, they can, yeah.
It's legal tender, they can do what they want with it.
What about his moral rights?
It would actually be very interesting to see what, if they decide to spend it on something, whether that can be a legitimate artwork. Whether that's a continuation of the original artwork.
Sorry, I'm going to fall off my chair with that. So if they go down and they buy something, then that becomes the artwork.
Potentially.
That's interesting.
Wow.
See?
I mean, see?
I mean, it's a conceptual work.
Oh, we're doing all the work for him. This is what, that's what, and not just about artists, but about writers and other things. When the audience has to do all this work to desperately try and find, I'm not saying you're desperately try and find meaning in it, then... I'm sorry, that person's not doing their job.
Mm. Well, it's a conceptual work, there's no two ways about it. And the questions it raises, obviously, are the intention of the artwork. The artist is wanting people to talk about value and...
waste in the arts.
And grants even. Clearly the Australia Council are aware of the money being used in this way. How he acquits it, I'm not sure. I'm sure it'll just be a one line, I sold it.
Do you think there's going to be sort of affidavits or like little clauses in future grants? This grant cannot be turned into cash and then sold to your friend.
Yeah. Well, I think that if someone tries to do it again, it's a one-go artwork. Yeah. You know, there's no, I'll make another artwork for $50,000. That's not happening. It's a one-shot statement.
Let's do $1 million. That's put into the Australia Council, yes.
I mean, clearly also the fact that the auction house got so involved says that, you know, it's about money.
Mm. The power of the auction house in the current art market world is, many would argue, a really negative influence over the value and role that art has in society. So I'm sure, I mean, if he had sold that through a commercial gallery, I don't know that it would have quite the same sort of symbology. But potentially because it's being sold through an auction house, it's raising all of their issues related to their role and their function.
Mm. I mean, in a sense, I think that every time a painting, particularly a contemporary painting or a modern artwork, goes to auction and is sold for large amounts of money, we have exactly the same argument.
Yeah.
I don't know what difference the fact that it's cash makes.
I think it comes down to creativity and technical skill and all those things that people expect from an artwork and an artist that just are not in that work at all. And I guess, I don't know whether that's a majority opinion, but that's what when I think art, I think, you know, someone who has a really unique talent and a really unique gift that not many people have and they're very fortunate to have, and it seems like anyone could do that. So... anyway, let's move on. Okay, we're moving on to Ned Kelly's Bones, and this is the Victorian government considering whether to put Ned Kelly's skeleton, which has been found recently, stuffed into an axe box and buried at Melbourne's Pentridge Prison, whether to put them on display.
It's interesting that we're talking about issues of value. I'm not sure that the bones of Ned Kelly are particularly interesting.
Well, I think the fundamental question with putting something like human remains on display and someone like Ned Kelly is, what are we going to learn about him and his story from his bones that we couldn't learn from an image of them?
Yeah.
Is there something in the authentic object that will speak volumes to us about his life and his story? And if so, there may be some justification for putting them on display. I don't think there is. I think that while ever there is family members who, you know, have a connection, whether it's tangible or intangible, that consideration needs to be made about their wishes.
Mm. I think there can sometimes be a case for putting remains on display. Mm. Even if they're, I suppose, we don't have any problems about seeing long lost ancestors, Neanderthal bones or skulls or, you know, the early, you know, Homo species. Mm. But in Sweden, the Wrecker the Vasa, which was a giant sort of warship that they built back in, I think, the 1600s, was heavily decorated and all the rest of it, and so heavily decorated as soon as it came out of the dock, it sank with a few people on board. And at their excellent museum that they have, where they've brought this up to the surface and done some amazing restoration work on it, they've actually taken, they've found some of the skeletons that were within that ship, and they've brought them up. And they've used it almost as a sociological study of life at the times. Mm. So they're saying, okay, this person, we think, because they've got records of who was on the ship and who was working on it, we think this person is probably, you know, say, Sven, the cabin boy. And they look at his bone structure, and the skeletons are laid out, and they talk in very scientific detail about, you know, the sort of diseases that you can see from the bones and what sort of diet he had and how hard he had to work and whether or not anything was broken and mended. And there's four or five of them there. Having said that, I don't know if they looked authentic, but then again, they were under glass and they could have been simply very good reproductions. Mm. But in either way, it was to actually have something inside to look at whilst taking in all that information. Mm. It's far better than having it just on a panel somewhere.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And I think, you know, reconstructions or fakes or images can potentially do exactly the same thing. It's about the use of the authentic object, the original human remains, that I think is more problematic than the images of it. And particularly for someone like Ned Kelly, where, you know, there is no place for the family to go and pay their respects or that kind of thing.
Where are they going to put him? Are we going to put together some sort of burial place for him and give him a tombstone? Because I was mentioning to Shona over lunch that if they put out a public appeal for funds, it would be Australia's biggest mausoleum, I think.
Yeah.
I'd throw a tenner at it.
I find it all very, very bizarre that institutions are kind of so desperate to do something with these remains. It, in a sense, it's as if we need to have something tangible. There's so much about Ned Kelly that is either myth or it's so mixed up with fact that, in a way, it's like, oh, well, if we display his bones, maybe things will make sense. And I don't think that they will.
I think there's plenty of tangible history connected to Ned already. We've got his letters, we've got his armour, we've got, you know, images of him, we've got, you know, most of Glen Rowan still there. You know, there's actual places you can go and you can experience his history firsthand. So I think from my point of view anyway, the desire to put his bones on display is very much a kind of roll up, see the curiosity mentality.
Freak show,
which is not the role of museums, certainly. And if that's the case, then why don't we put Edmund Barton's bones on display or, you know, Don Bradman's bones on display? Where do we stop in terms of why is it okay to do it to Ned, but it's not okay to do it to somebody else?
I think it's a case, there's definitely a case for cremation in the sense that if you get buried, someone's going to dig you up one day and, you know.
Yeah. We're talking about you.
You'll never, nothing.
In 100 years we're going to be talking about the bones of Kent Buchanan.
Well, there's nothing sacred. I think that even though he died in jail, and there's a sense that we own him now because he was a criminal, and that's where he ended up, and that's that we can do whatever we like to it, I still find kind of worrisome.
I think it's more complicated. I think it's, Jessica said, it's because he is. I mean, they're not digging up every executed criminal that they or anyone who died in Pentridge or old Melbourne jail. It's because it's Ned. And I think it is because even though we do have Glen Rowan and his letters, you know, there is something about going to visit a grave to know that that person, the remains of that person are, you know, 6 feet under, standing underneath you. That's why people go to, you know, visit Morrison's.
And Osama bin Laden was disposed at sea.
So the very thing wouldn't happen.
I just want to bring up the point Kent said about the case for cremation. If you visit Pompeii, this might be a fairly disgusting example, but if you visit Pompeii, they have poured plaster casts into the cavities of where people perished under the Vesuvius erupting, and the detail and the horror and fear on the faces of those plaster casts is highly disturbing, and you do feel like you're trespassing on, you know, the moment of this person's death. And, you know, we need possibly to keep that sacred. That is, you know, the most important moment of that person's life. And to several thousand years to have a parade of people gawking at it, it does feel slightly distasteful. And
well, I think it begs the question, what human remains are on display in a museum in Australia? And should Ned Keller be the first? I'm not aware of the remains of human beings, certainly from the modern era, that are on display in a museum.
I think even, I mean, there were, you know, obviously remains of Aborigines, Aborigines on display, but I think all of them have been taken away and are either in storage or are being returned, or there's certainly processes for returning them to the place where they came so they can be, you know, properly buried and given the rites. Yeah, I don't think they need to be on display.
No.
But it's going to be interesting as to what happens to them, where they're sent, and are they sent to a private again? Must he always be in an unmarked grave?
Yeah, I think there's something interesting about the question that it raises, that it would open up old wounds in the sense that, yes, up until recently, the remains of Aboriginal people have been displayed or in the collections of museums, not only in Australia but around the world, and that was okay because it was an ethnographic kind of scientific basis. And by putting Ned Kelly on display is not that dissimilar from examining, you know, the brains of criminals to find out, you know,
what makes them a criminal,
and essentially looking at them as a subspecies, if you like. I thought we were past all of that.
Clearly not.
All right, we'll leave our podcast there. Thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. If you have any comments or suggestions, please go to info@wpccdubbo.org.au.